Good afternoon and welcome to Regarding ID, the podcast series. This is your host, Chris Corum, the executive editor with Avizian Publications. And we're talking today with Mike Bond, security director for Cryptomatic. And we're going to discuss the exciting topic of passport security and the changes that are occurring from the basic access control procedures into the extended access control procedures. So, Mike, thank you very much for joining us today.
Hi there.
If we want to begin, I guess a good background probably would be to tell us a little bit about Cryptomatic and how you all your involvement in cryptography from the card world and other sides of the world. Give us a little background to the readers there.
Yeah, of course. So Cryptomatic is a software security company founded in the late 80s by a couple of academics from the University of Aarhus in Denmark. So we've been around on the scene as a security company for what's a pretty long time. And we started off in consultancy doing very specialist work to do with cryptography when banking was maybe one of the few industries which was using cryptography commercially. But since then we've grown and gotten involved in smart card security, particularly in EMV payments, things like data preparation for chip cards. And what's been happening recently is that we've expanded from there into the electronic passport world, because it turns out there are an awful lot of similarities between how you prepare data for smart chips for payment applications and for ID applications. Around about 2004, people really started to gain momentum for the contactless chip as a method of storing data on an e-passport. And so the first generation of electronic passports came along where you would have maybe a 20 kilobyte JPEG facial image, front view of a person's face and their biographical details stored on electronic chip on the passport, which can be read with a contactless reader. And that was really the starting point. But from there, people got a lot more ambitious. And as it started to become adopted internationally, and ICAO, the International Civil Aviation Organization, contributed towards standardizing it, people started to worry a little bit about, hang on, with all this vast amount of personal data flowing around and being collected by different countries, what about security? What about privacy issues? And so what we see in the e-passport world increasingly is additions to the protocols, the mechanisms, to make sure that the extra data which is stored is looked after a bit more securely. And so that includes basic access control, which was a security mechanism which was retrofitted to make sure that you couldn't have people just walking past somebody's contactless passport and skimming the data off. And now we have extended access control, which is focused around even more comprehensive security for extra biographical and biometric information like fingerprints and iris codes, etc.
Great. I remember the early days of the e-passport in the U.S. particularly, where the data was basically originally talked about as a free read kind of from that contactless chip, and the basic access control was an early means to say, okay, wait, we've got to at least ensure that it can't be read by subversively, say, by someone with a contactless reader walking by somebody else. So can you tell us a little bit about the basic access control as that first step, and then we'll get into the extended access control?
Yep. So roughly what happened with basic access control was that no one had an answer directly to the privacy concerns about skimming passports as you walk by somebody. And In order to try and address that, some people said, well, hang on, maybe what we should do is prevent the data from being read off until you provide a correct cryptographic key, which can only be produced if you've got optical access to the document, if you can physically see the data on the page. And so this basic access control consists of making a crypto key from the machine readable zone, from the bit that contains your name and your date of birth and your passport number, and hashing that all up into a crypto key. And that went some way to fixing the problem, but unfortunately, as a source of random numbers for producing good quality key material, it was a little bit insufficient, because it turns out that if you know someone's name, you can guess roughly when their passport was issued, you can figure out their date of birth from other databases, and before you know it, you can get most of the way to guessing that crypto key. So it turned out the basic access control, as a mitigating feature, ended up kind of opening up the passport projects to more fire from privacy advocates because they found something which they could pick even more holes in, the BAC scheme.
So then we moved on to extended access control, or I guess we should say we're beginning the process of moving on to extended access control.
We are indeed, but there's another technology which is worth pointing out, which is really quite a simple fix that a lot of people are looking at, which is to either put an electronic passport in a shielded sleeve or incorporate into the cover of the document electromagnetic shielding, which means that the contactless chip is much harder to access remotely unless you actually open the passport document or remove it from its sheath. And it's quite easy to convince people of this argument working compared with having to go through a long discussion about the strength of the crypto.
I would bet, though, that would not be your recommendation.
Well, I think it's actually quite a good mechanism.
Yeah.
But one of the things it doesn't deal with is access control to data that might be stored on a passport where you want to withhold it from people even if they have physical access.
Okay.
And what extended access control has been all about is saying, hang on, some of this data we consider to be so sensitive that even if you have physical access to the passport, even if you can see the page and open it up, we're still not going to let you get at, say, biometric fingerprint data unless you've got explicit permission.
Okay.
And that's something that the shielding can't do, of course.
And so how does extended access control handle that then, handle the securing of those biometrics on the car or on the chip?
Okay, so what extended access control does is, and by this I mean the EU version of EAC, it's a slight sort of misnomer in that extended access control is a general terminology for adding controls to prevent reading out of restricted data. But the first people to make a concrete stab at implementing it were the Europeans, and particularly the German BSI, basically the German spooks, who came up with a protocol to implement it. And so it basically uses a public key infrastructure on inspection systems, on the terminals which actually read the passports, so that a country who owns passports and issues them can delegate the permission to inspect them for a limited period of time to different inspection systems in different countries.
Hmm. So if it's a PKI type system, then does the passport itself have the private key how would that be handled?
It does indeed, yeah. So there are two additions to what the passport is doing. Firstly, each passport takes its own private key, and that allows it to resist counterfeiting and has all sorts of other benefits. But crucially, it also has, on time of issuance, a public key incorporated into it, which is the root key of the public key infrastructure belonging to that country, which it then uses to give permission to other countries to inspect.
Huh.
So just like your web browser has got the root certificate from Microsoft and from VeriSign embedded in it, your e-passport will have the root certificate from your issuing country embedded in it.
Okay, and so the country then would provide that key, the other side of that key pair necessary to read the passport to issuing stations wherever those might be around the world that they deem secure, sufficient, etc.
Well, it'll be done in a two-layer process. So there's something called a country verifying certificate authority, which is an issuing country sort of top line where they hand out permission on a country-by-country basis, and they'll issue a certificate, say, United Kingdom might issue a certificate to the French saying all French inspection systems can read biometric data for a period of 3 months starting from this date. And then that certificate then sort of gives permission to a private key and to a key pair which is held by the French Border Control Agency. And then they would then produce individual certificates for different inspection systems at different airports or seaports or land ports at different ports of entry.
Okay, I think I'm getting it, because I remember an early discussion of people saying, hey, wait, a private-public key infrastructure sounds like a great idea in these passport environments, but how are we going to manage the dissemination of these of keys to all of the devices out there around the world once this rolls out? So it sounds like what this system is doing is making it such that a country controls its own issuing device keys, but to their many devices, but each country only needs to be granted one key pair, say from another country. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's correct. And so there's a sort of a once every 3 month certification going on between different countries, and maybe a once every week or even a daily certification going on between countries' border control agencies and their individual inspection systems.
Okay.
But you have hit on a point there. For this complexity of a system, for this level of security, you can't expect it to be dead easy, or for that matter to be dirt cheap. It's actually quite a heavyweight solution in terms of meeting the problem head on and saying we're going to deploy a full public key infrastructure to try and solve this.
Now, is where is EAC from the standpoint of ICAO and a mandate or a planned mandate, or is this something that the EU countries have decided to do on their own and other countries are not planning to do, or what's the status with that?
Well, the European Union is pretty committed to it. There was some legislation that came from the EU Parliament in about 2004 that said fingerprint data must go on passports, and fingerprint data must be protected with some mechanism for extended access control. And now a working group of the EU Parliament, a couple of layers down, a committee, agreed and standardized on the protocol which was originally designed by the German BSI. And so pretty much everyone who's a member state of the EU is committed to putting on fingerprints and to issuing passports with fingerprints on by June 2009, so in just over a year's time. And it's a pretty frantic process at the moment to get all of the issuing infrastructure and interoperability testing done to make sure that countries can start issuing. So far, the only country to start issuing second-generation passports with fingerprints on is Germany, which started about 1st of November last year.
Okay.
The rest of the world is watching, though, and certainly Cryptomatic are finding that all sorts of people are inquiring and even putting together invitations to tender for extended access control of the EU flavor outside the European Union. So it's not inevitable that it's going to catch on, and I doubt that it will be mandated by ICAO, but it looks like it could run.
Okay. Is there another? You mentioned the EU flavor. Is there another flavor out there? Has another country or region proposed something that an extended access control process that's different from the EU version?
There are some different extended access control protocols. I believe that there's one in Singapore or one in the Far East, which has been developed with some success. And I know that IBM have got a protocol, the Conditional Access Control, or CAC protocol, as we call it. But I'm not sure that's really being a viable competitor at the moment. So there are a few things in the wings, but this German-based EAC, now a European thing, has got a lot of momentum. And I think if anything is going to catch on, then that will be it.
Thinking about the world in after, I think you said, was it November of 2009 when the EU passports?
I think it's June.
June of 2009. Okay. Thinking about the world post that date, we'll have two separate types of e-passports running around. You go to an issuing station in a specific country that may not be an EU country, and obviously you're going to see a first generation e-passport come through, followed behind by a second generation e-passport. Do those issuing systems, I suppose it's going to take an upgrade certainly to enable them to handle the cryptography of a second generation e-passport, but will those two be able to work in the same environments?
There's certainly interoperability in that a second-generation e-passport has all of the functionality of a first-generation one. And so if the inspection system, the reader, isn't aware that it's second-generation, then it should be able to get off everything except the biometric data, so your facial image and your biographical images and signature data, whatever, without going through or even noticing the additional features. So you do that, get that interoperability, but there's no kidding that there's a big change coming for border control agencies and for inspection systems, because it's almost a paradigm shift. Previously, if you have a passport in your hand, no matter who you are, you have the right to inspect it. So if you show me your passport, I can have a guess and have a look and see if I think it's a fake or not. If you take it to a border control, they can have a pretty detailed look. If you take it to the bank to use as a proof of ID, they can have a look. If you take it to Blockbuster Video, you know, to prove your membership, then they can have a look. But so inspectors have been very used to having the right to inspect. Mm-hmm. And now, because of this access control on biometric data, it's become not a right, but a privilege. You have to get permission to inspect things. And this means all of the border control infrastructure has to be upgraded to securely look after these private keys and the public key infrastructure, and even be audited by potentially hostile parties, audited by other countries to check if it's up to scratch. And no one has really seen how this is going to work in practice, whether or not one country is going to throw their arms up in horror at the idea of auditors on behalf of another country snooping around their border control systems to see if it's up to scratch to accept biometrics from that country.
Looking at this from the standpoint of the individual out there, and particularly any of our European listeners who may be sitting there thinking, wow, I waited in line last year to get my new e-passport. Am I going to have to go back and get a new one now after June 2009? What's the policy decision on replacement passports?
As far as I know, within the EU, there's going to be no accelerated program of replacement.
Okay.
And so if you had an e-passport issued or even a paper passport issued a month before they started coming in, that will be good until its expiry period.
Okay.
And so they're planning on having a fairly steady rollout. And it is worth saying that even though the issuing has got this quite tight deadline of June 2009, the inspection side has got no specific deadline, and so it's up to countries to, at their own rate, to deploy infrastructure to inspect these things. You may find that even 2 or 3 years after second-generation passports have had fingerprints added, that they're not actually having those fingerprints read out in any great quantities.
In the second-generation e-passport world, are my times waiting in line to get through security or immigration going to be longer, shorter? What's going to happen in that process?
It all depends on how a country chooses to roll it out. That's the challenge for them. Now, what we do know for certain is that second generation passports are going to be slower to inspect than first generation ones, because although the technology is improved and the communication rates have, the amount of data which is being stored is going up and up all the time. As you have 2 fingerprint images or 10 fingerprint images or iris information as well, and the limitations of the contactless interface come into play here. Because the guys who designed the original form factor for electronic passports wanted to go with a contactless interface so that it wouldn't get grimy, and so that it would they felt last about 10 years, the lifespan of a passport, then they went with this. But it's a double-edged sword because it limits the communication. And so in order to do a full read, even if you make all of the cryptography zip through lightning fast, you still have some slowdown there for the sheer amount of data. And people designing inspection systems are working really, really hard, and Cryptomatic is working hard to innovate in this area too, to drive down those inspection times. Because if not, rather than massive queues forming, what's going to happen is that the benefits of e-passports and a second generation won't be leveraged. You'll find that out of your queue, 80 out of 100 people will just have their passports looked at and won't have the electronic data read. 20 will have the electronic data read, and 2 will have the fingerprint data read. And so people are talking about deploying it in a third line inspection scenario where they've already expressed considerable suspicion about the person or about the authenticity of the document before they start doing fingerprint matching and reading out all of the data. Now, this means that an individual needn't worry too much about the queues driving up. But on the other hand, if there's some other political impetus, like there's a big international terror incident, we hope there won't be another one, but you never know, then if the whole world or whole countries move up to a higher state of alert, then in order to put through everybody on such a system with fingerprint matching, it could be an awful long time. So the answer is that one would hope, through being pragmatic, the queues won't increase, but in the worst case, they could, unfortunately.
Okay. Will the basic access control still be the, even in a second generation e-passport, will that hash of the machine readable zone still be required to initiate the first level of communication, or does basic access control go away in an extended access control environment?
Extended access control does indeed build on BAC, and so that step will still be done. And what we're seeing now is that a lot of the scanners for electronic passports, you open up the document, you do a full-page scan, which can scan and recognize that machine-readable zone in the absolute minimum amount of time so that you can get the reading underway straight away. Mm-hmm. So there's innovation in trying to make the inspection system readers get that data off faster. But yes, that step still has to be done because it's currently the only line of defense we have against the anonymity and the skimming attacks on e-passports.
Great. Okay, well, I think this has been a great education for me, and I hope for our listeners. I'm sure for our listeners as well, Mike. So I want to thank you. We've been speaking with Mike Bond, Security Director with Cryptomathique, and talking about their work with the extended access control for e-passport. So, Mike, I look forward to speaking with you again, and again, I thank you for your time here today.
No problem. Thanks a lot.
All right. Good day.